Everyone to the Second Court of Appeals for our 3 o'clock docket. We have one case set for oral argument. Before we get started, I'll introduce the panel. I'm Elizabeth Kerr. To my left, we have visiting Judge Mike Wallach. He's visiting with us from the Tarrant County District Court. And to my right is Justice Dabney Basil. I understand everybody has checked in, and so if we're ready, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you. You may begin, Mr. Springer.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Springer. I'm here with one of my associates, Aubrey Dameron, and we represent Mr. Starkey today. I want to prolong the introduction. Mr. Starkey was convicted of aggravated sexual assault of his daughter. The offense was 10 years removed or more from the trial. Our position is that the indictment notified him that he was being charged with the second degree felony of sexual assault rather than the first degree felony of aggravated sexual assault. And as a result, he was both convicted of an unindicted offense or alternatively, he was inappropriately sentenced as a result. The indictment in this case is interesting. There is plenty of case law, as the court knows from the briefing, about the sufficiency of indictments. In this case, the heading in the indictment, the preliminary section of the indictment, specifically identifies Mr. Starkey and identifies the offense as sexual assault of a child, a second-degree felony, and cites 22.011 of the Texas Penal Code, which is the appropriate section for the second degree offense. 22.021 is the section for the aggravated offenses. That's not what is alleged in the introductory paragraph. Then in the body of the indictment, of course, it alleges all of the elements necessary to prove that offense. But it also alleges that the child was under 14 years of age, which would have allowed the state, had it chosen to do so, to seek a conviction for the aggravated offense. This was brought up once and only once in the trial court. It was during the jury, jury examination before the jury was impaneled. And the trial court was reading the indictment to the jury, notified the jury that it was a second-degree felony that Mr. Starkey was accused of, and the prosecutor stands up, corrects the trial court, lets the trial court know that the prosecution intended to allege the aggravated offense rather than the second-degree felony, and the case goes on. The problem with that, of course, is what's alleged in this indictment and what was the defendant notified of at the time he was indicted. The case law since 2009 has shown a tendency in the Court of Criminal Appeals to get away from a more legalistic view of only the elements of the offense that are down below the caption of the indictment in favor of reading the indictment as a whole. In fact,
but isn't it also the case, Mr. Springer, that the way, and I'm looking at the Jenkins case that you referred us to,
yes,
isn't the standard really that the defect that a defendant is claiming must make it impossible for a defendant to know what offense he's being charged with?
I don't know necessarily that I agree with that, Your Honor. I think it would have been possible for him to know, but I think in the context of this indictment, he was only notified of this after the trial. I think the problem in this specific case is that the allegations in the indictment were sufficient to prove the second degree offense. If the allegations weren't consistent with the second degree offense, I might agree with the court that the disparity was such that anybody reading the indictment should have known what the state intended to charge him with. And we didn't cite it in our brief. There's actually a case that discusses that. It's Ruiz versus State, 501 Southwest 3rd, 179. The court in that case was confronted with a situation where the indictment did not allege the same offense that the defendant was convicted of, even though the state had a chance, as the state did in this case, to amend the indictment before the jury was impaneled. What the court said there was, just because everybody at the time of the conviction knew what the state intended, that doesn't excuse the state from not making that clear in the indictment. In other words, just because the state intended to pursue a certain offense doesn't mean the indictment necessarily would lead a defendant to that that conclusion.
Did Ruiz, in the case you just cited, us to object at any time to the indictment there?
He did not, Your Honor. And as a matter of fact, he pled guilty and was convicted basically on a plea of guilty. And the court there cited to the authorities that we cited in our brief, because I anticipated the court might have some questions about that. The case law makes it pretty clear that you can't waive this kind of defect in an indictment through inaction alone. You have to expressly waive that.
So you disagree that Article 1.14B of the Code of Criminal Procedure required your client to have made an objection to the indictment?
I don't believe my client was required to make an objection in order to bring his complaint to this court. I do think it makes a difference in the court's standard of review. And so, absolutely, I would.
So what would be the different standards of review that we would apply in each situation?
Well, if Mr. Starkey had objected at the trial court level, I think the standard of review would be harmful error. Because he didn't, I think it's egregious harm. But I think the record in this case pretty much demonstrates egregious harm, because he received a sentence that was 30 years higher than he should have received had the case proceeded on the second degree offense that was alleged. Now, the result in this court, if this court agrees with that argument, is a reverse and render. My position is that's absolutely warranted. But part of our allegation in this case, I will admit, is that indictment is sufficient to plead the second degree offense. And if the indictment was sufficient to do that, probably the jury charge was as well. And so that's why we made the second argument that the sentence was illegal, because the sentence is higher than he should have received had he had a trial over the second degree felony. It was 30 years higher. That's an error that does not have to be raised at the trial court level, can be raised at any time, even after his appellate review's been exhausted. And this court's got the ability to correct that by reverse and remand for an appropriate sentence under the second degree felony statute. So we've got that alternative pleading on file as well.
I know you've said that the younger than 14 years of age language that's in the indictment is basically surplusage, but would you ever see language like that in a second degree felony assault indictment, or the younger than 14 years of age is like a big flashing sign that we're talking about a first degree felony, right?
I certainly don't disagree that I've never seen it before. But I think, you know, in the context of these other cases, the Jenkins and Teal case that we cited, the more recent case, I think it's Strickland, that was decided by the Court of Criminal Appeals, what the court has done in those cases is, instead of viewing the body of the indictment itself, where the elements of the offense are alleged, what the court said, if there are omissions in those elements, and the context of the case and the context of the four corners of the entire indictment, including the caption, will supply the missing elements, then a defendant has sufficient notice under the Constitution of the United States to give him notice that he's the person that's been indicted, or that he's been indicted of a particular offense as opposed to something else. And you've got all three of those cases have different situations. One of them is where the defendant's name was omitted, but it was up in the caption. One of them is a case like we have here, where the charge in the caption is different than what was charged in the body of the indictment. And what the court said is, if you look at the context of the situation, what's charged in that caption is what the defendant had notice of, despite the fact that allegations are missing in the elements of the indictment. If it's true for that reason, it ought to be true in reverse as well. The trial court certainly thought that was true, because when the trial court read the indictment to the jury panel, the trial court thought we had a second degree felony case that was going to be tried. The prosecutor had to correct the trial court. So I don't know.
Now, are you saying at that point that there was some sort of affirmative burden on the prosecution to do more than just bring it to the trial court's attention?
Absolutely. I think if what the prosecutor should have done in that situation is ask the court for a recess, go amend that indictment, present the amended indictment, and then see if the trial court was willing to proceed with the trial or have a short continuance. And I think that's consistent with what the court in the Ruiz case said, which was everybody knew before Mr. Ruiz was sentenced that there were some problems with this indictment, and the prosecutors had plenty of time to amend that indictment, and they failed to do that. And having failed to do that, they made a choice as to what offense they were going to bring, even though they had evidence of something different. And I think that's essentially what happened in this case. The context is different, obviously. The context is different in all these other cases. We're not arguing that the court didn't have jurisdiction. We're just arguing that the defendant didn't have fair notice, at least until after this trial started, that he had been indicted of anything other than a second-degree offense. I'd like to just briefly touch on the hearsay issues. We've alleged four points of error under both these broad categories. I put the second broad category as the hearsay that was admitted by the trial court. It consisted of two different things. One is the trial court allowed testimony from two outcry witnesses when I believe the case law is pretty clear that only one of the outcry witnesses should have been allowed to testify, and that was the victim's mother, Kimberly Buckner. The other outcry witness, which was Annie Downey, her testimony was 10 years removed from the trial, which has implications in and of itself. If this young woman notified somebody 10 years before that there were problems with her father, I think that has implications beyond what happened at the trial, if nothing was done about it at the time. But beyond that, she clearly testified in the case that the allegations that she was notified about were general in nature and didn't touch on anything close to the elements of the offense that were alleged against Mr. Starkey. In addition to that, some 37 minutes of a police interrogation was admitted at the trial, which consisted largely of the police's characterizations of everyone else's allegations, which were clearly hearsay and testimonial statements. And the problems with that, of course, is that the jury heard all of this when what they should have heard was the outcry testimony from Mom, the testimony of the victim, and what little admissions the jury should have been allowed to consider from the police interrogation, from the law enforcement interrogation.
Don't courts have pretty wide latitude in admitting police interrogations, especially when, as here, the jury gets a limiting instruction telling them what they can and can't consider it for?
I'll say this, and Investigator Polly is actually here, so the police work in this case was great. There was nothing wrong with the police work. The problem is that great police work doesn't necessarily translate into admissible evidence during a trial, and while I certainly concede that a trial court's got a lot of discretion about admitting testimony, these police interviews consisted almost entirely of the investigators characterizing what other witnesses told them about the offense, and the jury heard that over and over and over again. And if you remove Ms. Downey's testimony and you remove the inadmissible portions of the police investigation, what you're left with is the, I'm sorry, may I finish my thought, Your Honor?
Yes.
You're left with an outcry witness who was going through a very heated, tumultuous divorce with her recently ex-husband. She recently remarried. She had a daughter that was obviously going through a tough time. And all that evidence was subject to some pretty serious impeachment by a good trial attorney. On the other hand, what we ended up having was the admission of lots of evidence of elements of the offense that the trial attorney had very little means of impeaching. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, Counselor. Mr. Singleton.
May it please the court. The entire argument here is not, and counsel has conceded this, it's not that the indictment itself is fundamentally defective, is constitutionally infirm. It's a question of what exact crime was alleged in the indictment. Now, counsel cites several cases, including Jenkins versus State and several others, but I'm going to talk about Jenkins versus State first of all because of my limited amount of time, and I'm going to suggest that all of them follow about the same pattern. They can be distinguished from the instant case in several different ways. Number one, all of them are addressing the issue of, and I'm quoting from Jenkins here, whether the indictment, although in effect defective, was still an indictment that met the jurisdictional requirements under Article 5, Section 12B of the Texas Constitution. In other words, was the indictment sufficient to confer jurisdiction on the trial court? And it's very interesting the way they do that. And let me skip ahead for a minute. Because in one case, well, I actually don't see right here. In one case, they look at the caption. In another case, Kirkpatrick, I think, and Teal, they look at the fact that the body of the indictment itself, what we would traditionally and what Texas has held to be the indictment, the part on the page that starts below the caption, looking at that, clearly alleged misdemeanors. There were lacking the elements, there were lacking the allegations that would elevate the crime from a misdemeanor to a felony. And the courts looked at several things. Number one, the caption. Number two, the fact that the case was filed in a district court, and a district court by definition lacks misdemeanor jurisdiction. And number three, they looked at the overall circumstances. And what I want to point out is none of those, what they did in each of those cases, was look beyond the indictment. And that's important. Because what I cite Jenkins for, the first Jenkins, and honestly, I cited it for the Horn Book illustration that talks about how since 1988, Texas courts have always drawn a distinction between the indictment proper and the caption. And that's really what this case is entirely about. It's not an issue of, is this enough? There is, again, no issue at all. Does the indictment allege a first-degree aggravated assault of a minor? It does. That's what the addition of the language, the child was under 14 years of age, does. Now, this is very important because in the record, what the judge did, and I can only assert this, but he's looking at the caption because that's the easiest way to do it instead of reading through and mentally trying to figure out what the language of the indictment charges. He looked at the caption, and the caption said a second degree, sexual assault, a second degree felony. And at that point, the judge says, Mr. Starkey is charged with sexual assault of a child. It says on the indictment that that's a second degree felony. Prosecutor, Your Honor, may we approach? The prosecutor and defense counsel both approach. It's wrong. It should be first degree felony. It's aggravated. It was submitted from the sheriff's department and didn't get changed on the, I apologize. He's talking about the caption. When the cases come into intake, at least in our office, the charges from the police report are entered into the caption, which is used then by the clerks. They serve no purpose other than to tell the clerk how to file it. All right? Court says, all right, it's okay. Actually, and he turns and faces the jury, actually, I incorrectly stated on the indictment, it's a first-degree felony, and the attorneys will discuss that with you each in just a few more minutes. Now, at this point, if there had been any question at all, it was incumbent on defense counsel to stand up and say, objection, Your Honor, we've been under a misconception, we're not prepared to go on this serious charge. We would either object to proceeding and make an argument then, or ask for continuance.
So do you disagree with Mr. Springer that the failure to object goes only to the standard of review that we apply, or are you saying that any deficiency in the indictment has been waived?
I'm saying this deficiency has been waived. Had it been a challenge to the constitutional infirmity of the indictment, that would be a different issue. But at this point, it's not. The only question, we've got an indictment. The court, undeniably, no one is suggesting that it doesn't have jurisdiction. The only question is, what's he charged with? And really, if you look at this, the whole question, if I can oversimplify it, boils down to one thing. Does the caption actually trump the language of the indictment? We've provided cases, and they're innumerable, but in our brief, dating all the way back to 1988, saying there has always been a distinction between the caption and the indictment proper. Now, in the first place, Jenkins is distinguishable because it's looking at constitutional sufficiency, and that's a different issue. And Jenkins even talks about that and acknowledges that. It's distinguishable in a second way, though. All of the cases that we're looking at here involve missing elements, all right? And that's where we get into the second part, which is, do we have adequate notice? Because in the body of the indictment, in the cases, you don't have an element. In two of them, you don't have an element that's sufficient to raise it up from a misdemeanor to a felony.
So you would say that here Mr. Springer's arguing that we have an extra element that didn't need to be there because it doesn't match the caption.
Here I'm saying in footnote number 4 in their reply brief, what they constantly do is try and label it as surplusage. It's not surplusage. If the caption weren't there, it wouldn't be surplusage in any indictment. And if there was some question that it was surplusage, at that point in the trial, there was time to raise an objection and ask for a continuance. Had they not done that, then you would come up, if it had been a question of, you know, the constitutional infirmity, then it would come up to the court, and the court, I think, in this case, would measure it de novo, because it's a pure question of law as to whether an indictment is constitutionally sufficient or constitutionally infirm, or whether it is, in fact, sufficient to vest the district court with the power to hear the case. But that's not what they're doing. And what Mr. Springer's doing is he's taking cases that deal with other issues, because there have been, over the history of Texas, just all sorts of challenges to indictments. All right, he's taking a very narrow range of cases that look at missing elements, that look at constitutional infirmity, that basically ask, is an indictment under the Texas Constitution? And then trying to use that to bootstrap into his argument. For example, he says that it's an illegal sentence. Well, it's only an illegal sentence if you assume that the caption preempts the language of the indictment. And what I'm going to suggest is not only is that argument contrary to more than 100 years of Texas law, not only is it just inconsistent with what the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure seems to say rather clearly, it's untenable on its face. The most the inconsistency could ever do, at the time this case was decided, I'm sorry, Judge, I've had some drainage and I took some.
Sure. I think this time of year we all feel your pain.
I apologize. I lost my train of thought. I shouldn't have drunk any water. The most that's going to happen is if you have an inconsistent caption and consistent, adequate, and there's no doubt, there's no argument by either party that the language in the indictment itself is adequate, are we now going to say that the caption trumps the language of the indictment? Because if it doesn't, and even if it's just an inconsistency, and even if that creates some question, not as the constitutional infirmity, because look at the other two cases, Teal and Kirkpatrick. They said, one of them said, and it was admittedly dicta, that if you filed an indictment that charged someone with speeding, that would be enough to be an indictment constitutionally because it charges a crime. It says two things. You've got to have a person and you've got to have an offense. All right? But at that point, you'd have to decide what the offense was. Well, here, there's no question about the offense. There's no question the language of the indictment itself clearly states a first-degree felony. So the only issue is, number one, does the caption trump it? Number two, if it doesn't, then all it does is create an ambiguity. And at that point, it's my contention, they've waived their argument by not objecting. Both of them, they're standing right there. Both of them, the state is saying, that's a typo. That's not, that came from the police department. It never got changed. It's clearly the caption. It's in the record.
What about the argument about the outcry witness?
First of all, now, what happened here? Annie Downey, who was the babysitter back in 2004 when all this occurred, she said, one day we're watching TV, Taylor said, people touched her. I said, okay, I touch you. She said, yeah, but it's different. I said, okay, and she said, sometimes the way people touch me make me feel uncomfortable. When I asked her who, and she said, I can't tell you, it would make things inaudible. And reporter says, I can't tell you what? The witness, I can't tell you because it would make things rough. So I let it go. This is Miss Downey. And a little while later, she just kind of stopped, and she looked at me, and she said, I'm going to tell you who it is. And I said, okay, who is it? She said, my daddy. And I didn't push any further. I waited for Kim to come home that night, and I told her. So that's the total of the first outcry witness. I'll be honest, that's not much of an outcry witness, but I don't think that's really the issue here. I think the more important issue is, did we have two outcry witnesses? So we call later the victim's mother, Kimberly Buckner, and then the following exchange takes place. Now, prior to that time, did you have a conversation with your daughter, the victim, about an incident that occurred between the defendant and her? Yes, sir. All right, and what did she tell you? She told me, defense, objection to hearsay, Your Honor, in violation of the Confrontation Clause. The court, at this time, I'm going to sustain the objection. So, the counsel goes on. Let me ask it this way. I'm not asking for specific details based on the court's ruling. I'm just asking in general, did she give you some information that caused much concern? Answer, I was scared because it was information that I had been told years ago. The same information? Yes, sir. So, she's not giving you what is technically, and I hate to be hyper-technical, but that's not outcry testimony, because she's not really talking about it. She's not relaying what her daughter told her. She started to do that, I'll admit, but the trial court stopped it. Now, later on, and so our first position is there really weren't two outcry witnesses. Now, later on, during her testimony, Ms. Buckner, the mother, she goes on, she testifies that Ms. Downey had originally stated that the victim said that what happened was that Mr. Starkey had touched her inappropriately and had licked whipped cream off of her genitalia, and Mr. Pearson, the trial attorney for Mr. Starkey, I'm running out of time, again objects. Very briefly.
Oh, your red light's not on.
Okay. I guess I've got 2 minutes. Very briefly. First of all, the objection to the second testimony, the mother, I don't think, ever testified as to what the daughter told her initially. Now, the second time, she's talking about what the neighbor, the babysitter, told her. And the objection there should have been hearsay, but if you go back and read the objection, the objection's under the outcry statement. Now, technically, it could be hearsay within hearsay, but I think, first of all, you don't have a proper objection. But the second thing I would say, since I'm very low on time, it's harmless. In this case, you had evidence of flight. You had evidence of the girl, the victim, just falling apart, suicidal, institutionalized, serious problems that continue to develop. You have evidence that is admitted later on that the father continued to sexually abuse her later on up in Oklahoma. You had the father's statements in the interrogation, and most importantly, then you have this statement, this one statement, which is the only one that I saw, which technically isn't a violation of the outcry statute, although that's arguable, which is the only objection that I saw that was made. But it introduces the interesting thing that she said, he touched me, and if you look at the victim's testimony, she says, I gave him oral sex. And it says she licked whipped cream, off his genitals, and the victim is again asked on direct, was there whipped cream involved? Did you ever lick whipped cream off? No, I didn't. Basically, those two statements were powerful impeachment arguments. May I finish my sentence?
You can wrap up one sentence.
They didn't hurt. They helped. They were absolutely contradicted by the victim's testimony later on.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to make clear what our argument is, because I'm not sure counsel maybe misperceives it, but our argument is not that this indictment is defective. Our argument is that this indictment does not support the offense that Mr. Starkey was convicted of. And those are two different things. Now, I'll concede that some of the cases that we filed have to do with courts looking at the jurisdictional argument of whether the indictment is sufficient, but and that is a different context, as I said earlier. But I think what should be important for the court to consider is the rationale that the Court of Criminal Appeals uses and some of these other courts use that have evolved substantially since that 1937 case that counsel talks about that makes that big distinction between the caption and the body of the indictment. Those more modern cases they don't overrule the old case, but what they do say is that in determining what an indictment alleges, you cannot focus solely on the elements of the offense alleged. You have to look not only at that, but also at the caption and also at the circumstances. And one of the examples is that Jenkins case that we brought to the court's attention in our supplemental brief. What happened in Jenkins is that there were allegations in the caption that did not exist down below. And what the court said when it looked back on Teal and Strickland is that we held in those cases that although the indictment properly charged a misdemeanor and lacked an element necessary to charge a felony, the felony exists. The indictment was filed in a felony court, not a misdemeanor court, And not only that, the face of the indictment contains a heading just like this one does. Indictment, tampering with a government record, third-degree felony, and citing to a penal code section. And the court said, that notation that the offense was a third-degree felony clearly indicated that the state intended to charge a felony offense and the district court had subject matter jurisdiction. That's what happened here. That caption was the state's notice to the defendant that it intended to pursue the second-degree felony, even though the elements in the indictment included more than was needed to prove that.
But isn't there a difference between saying that where the caption tells you that we're prosecuting a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor? Isn't that substantially different between one felony and a higher felony, where the higher felony is in the body of the indictment?
I think only to the extent that in that case they are looking at the constitutional issue. In this case, what we're looking at is the sufficiency of the indictment to support the conviction. And I still think the court ought to take that rationale into consideration. We looked for a case that was what Judge Houston used to call a white horse case. It was exactly like this. We were unable to find one, so we did the best we could.
Your argument is that document gave you reasonable notice that you were charging, that state was charging a second-degree felony, and that's what they're stuck with.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And I think it would be different if they had alleged maybe aggravated assault, and then what they had, if the caption had aggravated assault in it, and then in the elements of the indictment, what they had alleged was an aggravated sexual assault, because then I think you could look at that and go, well, now wait a minute, aggravated assault is not even a lesser included offense of what they've alleged here. So they could not have been accusing me of just an assault. They had to be accusing me of a sexual assault. But in this case, that's not what happened. The allegations were entirely consistent with the second degree. Thank you so much
for
consideration.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Your argument was very illuminating, and your case is now submitted.